The Goal Line Club brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. Ryan, we have talked about it all season. Now is the time to be a member because, frankly, the season's coming to an end. And frankly, this Gopher football team needs all the help they can get. So sign up now, pad your resume, add you are a Gopher booster. Go to goalineclub.org.
Again, it's really simple. You go there, you click on memberships at the top of the page. Once you get to that page, you'll click the join now. And what I'll remind you once again, 100% of your donation goes directly to the Gopher football program.
Welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns. And we welcome you guys back to yet another Iowa loss. And if you think to yourself, am I listening to the same one that, well, was in 2021 where the Minnesota offense dominates in the trenches? The Minnesota offense runs the ball as well as we've seen a team do against Iowa all season. And then you look up at the scoreboard at the end of the day, and the Gophers lose for the eighth consecutive game to Iowa. No, your ears do not deceive themselves. This is the 2022 edition. As much as things change, they stay the same. And yet another Gopher loss, 13-10. Somehow Minnesota finds a way to lose to the Iowa Hawkeyes in a game that is filled with so many plays that we need to get into. And joining us tonight, as always, is my second cousin, Dinky Town Athlete's Own, Derek Burns. Derek, how many more years in a row are we going to have to do this podcast and say Minnesota tries to essentially out Iowa, the Iowa Hawkeyes, for the umpteenth straight year, and they lose another football game?
Well, I don't have a good answer for you. Hopefully not many. I'm glad to be back. I appreciate you guys having me on again. And win or lose, I'm excited to talk college football as always, but it was frustrating and there is a lot to talk about, certainly.
All right. So for the sake of, you know, the listener, I actually suggested that we take the 2021 episode. I go in and edit the words home and away. And we just republish that one with new ads because honestly, that's what this felt like. But then everybody reminded me that Mo Ibrahim did not play in that game. So that wasn't going to work because he was an absolute monster in this game. And both of the running backs that amassed massive amounts of yards last year no longer play on the team. So that wasn't going to work. I thought we were going to get the night off. You know, our significant others were going to be very happy, but the reality is we have to record this episode. So Ryan, as you said, another year, another close, but it didn't count. That in the end, all I know is close only counts in, horseshoes and hand grenades, and this is football. So, here we go. Let's get into this one, fellas. The Gophers lose 13-10 at home against the Iowa Hawkeyes. The Gophers amassed 399 yards of total offense. Only 87 of those were through the air. 312 of those were on the ground. Mo Ibrahim, he amassed 263 yards of rushing. He had one touchdown. That on 39 carries. Can you say he was a bell cow? Absolutely. And I think we have to start first and foremost, Derek, with Mo and the phenomenal effort he put in. Just probably his best effort I can remember as a Gopher running back.
Well, definitely. You know, as any person who's seen an Iowa game over the last decade would know, they play the same defense. They have not changed schemes for the most part. They play a matchup zone, essentially. Some people call it man under two, but they keep two high safeties. The safeties react and they'll crash quickly on run. They're a very stout run defense. We talked about that even at the end of last week's recap. So for Mo to have the day like he did is impressive against any team, but against a team like Iowa, you know, you can just add to that. So from a scheme standpoint, just a couple things that I think were very effective. The mid zone, which is something that they debuted against Northwestern, which is your stretch play, your mid zone. In other words, it's not outside zone around the end, but it's not inside zone. That gave Iowa, and particularly the inside linebackers, gave them a lot of trouble because it forces them to cover more space east to west, which was also a factor in last year's game. And then the zone read, so the one that Ethan kept a couple of times, but on the plays that he didn't keep it, it helped tremendously to isolate both the backside defender, but also the inside linebackers, as I mentioned on the previous. In mid zone. So those two things working in tandem really, I think, were what helped Mo get a little bit of room. And we've seen in previous games when he has even a crease, he's able to get many times 6, 7, 8 yards a carry, even when there's almost nothing there. And then, of course, you know, when there is something there or there's a mistake made, he was able to break some big gains.
He had the game of his life. I don't know how else to construe that. In terms of, he did something that hasn't been done this century against the Iowa Hawkeye defense, and that's run for 200 or more yards. He does that for the first time against an Iowa defense that a team or a guy has done in 22 years, and Minnesota still finds a way to lose the football game. Not only did he run for 200, he ran for 263. And it's just, you know, I was talking with some people behind the scenes around the Gopher Complex, and from what I've heard, that was arguably the highest graded internal game that they've had Mo Ibrahim at. And I don't know if that makes me more angry or happy for him or just about the whole situation, but the way he was able to essentially put the team on his back. And now we can have Derek assess the offensive line. He's a lot more, yeah, I mean, he knows the ins and outs a little bit better than I do, obviously. I didn't think the offensive line necessarily played a great game. I think they played a good game, but Mo Ibrahim was just incredible. And it's just, it makes me so sad for that kid that he gets his 10th consecutive carry on a drive. And it happens to be that he fumbles it. It's his fourth career fumble. And I believe over 850 touches in a Gopher uniform. And from the way it's been explained to me kind of behind the scenes and the way I viewed it on the rewatch, it was the helmet of the whoever number 34 is for Iowa that Mo doesn't account for the just a helmet in terms of a face mask hitting the football. He's got two hands on the football. 34 comes down. He doesn't see him. It hits him, hits the ball, pops out, and Minnesota loses possession within their own 15. And you just feel for him. I know that some people want to blame Fleck on that one. There's a lot of things that we can discuss with PJ Fleck. Mm-hmm. I don't think Mo Ibrahim getting a 10th consecutive carry is one of them. The way he was cooking on that entire drive, do I believe he might have been a little out of gas? Sure. Do I know that there's no team in college football that Mohammed Ibrahim wanted to beat more than the Iowa Hawkeyes? Yes. Are you going to pull Mo, who has carried your entire offense the entire game, on that play in the red zone? Absolutely not. So I just, Luke, I'm just so frustrated with the whole bit because Mo played as well as we've ever seen. Mo Ibrahim deserved to win that football game, and it just wasn't in the cards because it's a team sport, and it sucks. So that's where you look at the stats now, Luke. Mo Ibrahim, according to Pro Football Focus, has over 1,000 yards on the season after contact.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Like, I cannot, like, to put that into words, folks, Mo Ibrahim, if you just took out all the yards that were before contact, would still rank 5th in the Big Ten in rushing if you just took his yards after contact. That's how good he has been. That's how good he was on Saturday. And, Derek, I would even say, like, there were opportunities in the passing game for Ethan to check down to Mo in a couple spots, but we can get to that in the passing game. It's just, Luke, I'm very frustrated that Mo has the game of his life, and he is a tremendous football player. We've talked about that now for years. Mm-hmm. One of the best to ever wear the uniform. And he has the game of his life, and it still doesn't mean Minnesota finds a win.
Yeah, it is frustrating in the end. Individual performances you always look back on, and you know, you're like, wow, what a game. but you know, it does have a blemish when you don't come out with a victory, and that's the part that's disappointing with that. You know, you really feel for Mo in that situation. Just from my take and my vantage point, both watching it live and then watching it back, it really seemed like, again, Mo understands the situation and he was going to be short on the first down, and it looked to me like he was maybe even stretching, which ultimately, you know, ended up costing him the fumble there. You know, I'm not going to blame him for the loss. There's so much more that goes into that. He played his tail off, but man, you know, a great play by the Iowa defense, and you know, they continued to bend and not break, Derek. I mean, that's the reality of this situation. The Gophers amassed a ton of yardage, but in the end, the points are what matter, not the yards.
Yeah, I mean, that's been Iowa's calling card. You know, turnovers, of course, have been there. That's their number one key to success. But yeah, the red zone defense. I mean, things change in the red zone. That sort of suffocating defense that they play, Minnesota's able to stretch them out a bit, you know, in the open field, you know, with a few passes in the first half. But then again, those running plays we talked about, even outside zone. But when you get into the red zone, it obviously takes away a responsibility from the secondary. They have, in essence, a 12th defender back there, which is the back of the end zone, and that helps them. So it shrinks everything down. They're able to just become more effective, more suffocating. And that certainly, I can't remember the stat we talked about, but three trips to the red zone, I think, in the second half resulted in 3 points, something like that.
The final three resulted in 3 total points. You're never going to beat the Iowa Hawkeyes if you're averaging 1 point per red zone red zone possession on your final.
And I mean, it's not a problem that's unique to the Gophers. I mean, not a challenge that's unique to the Gophers. Other teams have certainly struggled with that, but you know, again, we can, you know, we talk about the passing game and play selection, et cetera. We can probably expound on it, but that was the key to the game. Certainly was the lack of production in the red zone.
Yeah. In the end, you know, when you run the style of offense that Minnesota runs, or you even run more of a spread, conceptually and from an X's and O's standpoint, the red zone becomes much more challenging and execution is much more key. So I think this is a good opportunity to transition and talk a little bit about the passing game. You know, on the day, Ethan Kalyuk Manis was 7 for 15. This is pretty much what he's been effectively all season. If you throw in terms of like completion percentage, you know, he had 87 yards and an interception. When you're down in the red zone, it is much more challenging to execute, but there are opportunities. And frankly, you saw some of the warts of a redshirt freshman quarterback. I think specifically to the play where he ends up kind of throwing across his body when, if he just is able, you know, there's a little pressure in his face, but is he able to just float it over to Brevin Span Ford coming around off motion? And I think it was Riley Moss was trailing on the play. If he's just able to drop that over, that's for sure a first down, if not a touchdown, right? And they're just seemingly some missed opportunities there. You know, and you have to execute, Derek, in the red zone like that. If you can't execute there, you know, your margin for error is so much slimmer because it's so much harder to execute. And when you have those opportunities, you just have to take advantage of them.
Well, yeah, it's Ryan and I talked about this offline that, and again, let me just first say, you know, criticism here of Ethan is this is game three. So he's going to learn, he's going to improve, he's going to be well coached. He's got a long way to go and hopefully many good things ahead. But, you know, one of the things we picked up on is he has now multiple times missed his underneath routes, whether that's a check down or whether that's a low to high progression. I'm not sure why that is. He likes to push the ball downfield, which frankly isn't the worst thing in the world, but the play you're mentioning, Luke, I mean, the read there is low to high. Brevin's in the flat, and they've got two routes, you know, down to the second level near the goal line. And as soon as that edge player blitzes, or I guess maybe it's not even a delayed blitz, it's just as soon as he commits to the rush, the read there is to throw the ball to Brevin. And there's pressure in his face, but Ethan is a big body. He's tall enough to get that throw over the pressure. Hopefully not. He can avoid a knockdown pass. And the way it opened up, I mean, that's the throw, and your read is low to high, but he looks off it basically a millisecond too early and ends up throwing downfield. But, you know, that's a 7-point mistake. I mean, ultimately is missing that read. And again, it's something we've picked up in other games as well. So they'll go over it in the film room. Certainly they'll get them coached up. But at this point it's a slight trend, and it certainly hurt them in that case. And
I just want to bring up, like, Ryan, you had an astute point in the preview episode where you said, you know, touchdowns are going to be at a premium and you've got to convert on touchdowns. And that was just that's just an opportunity. You know, one, the Gophers didn't execute on the field goal, but the fact they missed the touchdown is even the thing that hurts even more in this kind of game.
Field goals are failures. Let's remind people of that. You never want to settle for a field goal, especially against Iowa. And that's where, again, we're spending a lot of time on this one play. And it sucks that, to Derek's point, Ethan moved his eyes a split second too soon. But also, to Derek's point, we have a small sample size to work with. But it is interesting that low to high progressions, or even just like the checkdowns, I mentioned them in a couple of my GIF rewinds, or a couple of the GIFs and the GIF rewinds I go for Illustrated. And there were a couple times in this game where Mo Ibrahim is just absolutely wide open as a checkdown. And again, Ethan's eyes are down the field and he just breaks the pocket or tries to force it. But it's like, again, you don't want to fault the kid for actually looking down the field, but you also have to understand that the clock is ticking in terms of that pocket isn't going to hold forever. You need to get the ball out of your hands. And especially if you can get into the hands of one of the best running backs to ever wear a Gopher football uniform, I mean, he can catch ball a little bit. So again, that it's frustrating because this isn't the first time, especially on this specific type of play. I think back to, I think it was the Nebraska game. He missed Brevin Spanford in the specific route, the drag coming across the middle on play action, eluded, and he threw the exact same pass across the middle, didn't convert it. You'll remember back to the Northwestern in that same, like literally the same spot on the field just 1 week ago. Brevin is held. Ethan just keeps it with his legs, goes down to the one. And then here he just doesn't find him. And if he just flips it over the head of the linebacker, it's 14-10 at halftime. Mm-hmm. And this game may be a lot different. Now, I think what people want to talk about too, and it's worth discussing, is the play call. Now, if it's executed, it's a touchdown. But I understand that if we want to do the whole hindsight's 20-20 thing, Minnesota doesn't have any timeouts. And they burned their last timeout with 11 minutes left in the half. And that's an issue.
We got to get into the fact, like, isn't it the play before they run that? Brevin and Dalen Wright just absolutely flip a lid? Is it that play right before it, or was that the drive before when they? Yeah, that's so the
that
drive before
play
when they.
Is with 11 minutes left in the first half.
Oh, but the point, where, the thing that's so frustrating about that is this staff routinely burns timeouts on situational stuff where they either don't have the look they want or something, and they end up burning timeouts, and it's starting to really wear on me. I've heard PJ's philosophy on it, and I understand and I get the logic, but it's just really starting to wear on me.
So I'm going to run you through the three timeouts that PJ took in the first 20 minutes of the game. He took a timeout to punt the ball on fourth down, like
because they were going to go for it, and then they decided to punt.
Does anyone on this podcast the three of us has watched PJ Fleck football for a long time. Does anyone here believe that PJ Fleck was actually going to go for this?
He did it in the Ohio State game, but that was a totally different situational game. No, I don't think he's going to go for it.
Not in this particular game.
So he burns it, punts it. Second one, Minnesota has it, or Iowa has it at the goal line. He has to burn a timeout because the Gopher defense only has 10 guys on the field. They're missing a safety.
Which, for the life of me, how does that happen? Like, I don't, situationally, like, how does that just happen?
And then with 11 minutes left in the game, it's funny because I actually gift this play specifically. There are three people irate about this play. PJ Fleck sprinting down the sidelines because the way it looks to me, they're trying to change the play call, and it's very Mike Sanford-esque where there's like 5 seconds left on the play clock. But Brevin is irate, and Dalen Wright is irate that whatever that was, they have to burn the final timeout. Because what I come back to is that play call that Minnesota misses Brevin Spanford on with 47 seconds left in the game on that third and one, I believe at the Iowa 16. If you have a timeout left there, you give the ball to Mo.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get it, then you call your timeout. But you, if you just have a timeout there, I think that it's handled a lot differently. But because Fleck is so liberal with his timeout usage in the first half, it definitely hurt Minnesota in my eyes. Again, hindsight's 20/20, and it's easy for me to say that when 0 points result of it, because a quarterback doesn't see the tight end a split second too late, and then special teams, which can't wait to get to that later. But
the thing that's frustrating to me, especially on, because I'm with Brevin and Dalen on why you call that time, like, why do you call that timeout? It's first and 10. And I get that you're on the 12, but like, I'm assuming a pass is called because they have
Jalen Wright's on the field and he ain't out there to run block.
Yeah. And the thing is like, he's got, I think it's Riley Moss on him, but like they basically have man coverage under with the safety shaded like pretty significantly to the center of the field. And I feel like, you know, they felt they had something there.
It looked like it, the way it's set up, it was going to be Riley Moss versus Dalen Wright. Let's see who's better.
Which, and frankly, Riley Moss is awesome, but like, you, I'm gonna give Dalen a shot in the end zone on a jump ball, right? Like, I'm not going to say he's going to win it every time, but this is the kind of one where you think back to the Ohio State game where he caught an incredible ball, you know, over his shoulder. I get that Riley Moss is super good, don't get me wrong, and he probably can make a play on it, but I'll take my shots there on first and 10 like that.
Yeah, I think it just gets back to, then you look at the passing game in the second half, fellas, and this is where I want to go, is Minnesota completes one pass in the second half. They're 1 of 8 for 14 yards and a pick. Now, before I step up on my pedestal and give my thoughts and feelings, I want to kick it to Derek, because Derek, you and I talked about this extensively here in the last 24 hours since the game.
Mm-hmm. Well,
one thing I want to note to folks is this. On the one touchdown possession of the entire game for Minnesota, they had 61 passing yards on that. The next three red zone, or the next three drives for Minnesota that went into the red zone, they had a total of 14 yards through the air. So I wonder what is one of these things is not like the other, and one of these things just doesn't belong. But Derek, floor is yours.
Well, this has, I think, been the subject of some spirited debate. I mean, since the game was over, as you'd expect on a frustrating loss. And I think one camp says, you know, why didn't they throw the ball more? And the other camp says, you're crazy. Mo Ibrahim was going nuts. Why would you even consider throwing the ball more? Just go with what's working. Here, I don't know that it's that black and white, but here's where I'm at. And you kind of, you led with it well, Ryan. Minnesota starts the game off with a, you know, let's call it a conservative ball control approach. They get down 10 to nothing, and they decide we have to somewhat abandon that approach, open things up a little bit, if that's the wording you want to use. And on that drive, they looked really good. They looked good running the ball. They looked good passing the ball. I think you said 61 yards passing. I mean, that was their, I mean, it resulted in a touchdown, you know, by any measurement, that was their best drive of the game. And I'm not, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you if every other drive for the rest of the game would have looked like that if they had kept that same approach. But what happened is, you know, they brought them to within 3 points. It became a one score game for the rest of the game. And they, I mean, in my opinion, they went back to much more of a ball control conservative approach. And I'll just say this, you know, and when we talk maybe at the end about, you know, some reflection on the season and where we're going and whatever, I don't know that the answer is just simply throw the ball more. To me, the answer is you need this offense, this team, this season needs more explosive plays somehow, some way. Now, easier said than done, but that to me is what was lacking. You certainly weren't lacking consistency. You certainly weren't lacking control of the line of scrimmage. You certainly weren't lacking time of possession. You certainly weren't lacking a good running back. What they were missing was explosive plays. They had a couple of them in the run game, but it wasn't enough. And so that is my criticism, Ryan, of the second half passing, which I think where, you know, when you and I talked earlier, where we arrived was, maybe the passing was so ineffective because you just didn't get that many chances. And it was so far and few and far between that there's more pressure on those plays. You're probably passing in more obvious passing situations, and you just got nothing out of your pass game. And ultimately, that was needed one way or another.
So before I kick it to Luke, here's where I'm at, Luke. And by the time people have listened to this, I've probably gotten to PJ Fleck's Monday press conference. But I'm going to tell everybody what my question or my first one will be to him tomorrow. And I understand that people aren't going to like it because they want me to just ask the head ball coach, you know, you suck, you should be fired, why is the passing game an abomination? But you have to think of it through the lens of someone like myself, where I know the question, but I want to be able to elicit a response from him that doesn't immediately put him into his shell, doesn't immediately put him on the defensive. And Derek and I have tried to work on this question. And so here's the question that I'm going to ask. It's, when you evaluate the program as a whole, it appears the defense and running game are in really good shape, but other than just executing, because that's what Fleck continues to go back to over and over and over again in 22 about passing game issues. So other than executing, do you think there's a philosophical change that's needed in the passing game? So why am I asking that question? Because it's clear that it's now been 3 years where PJ Fleck just doesn't have any trust in his passing game. And to Derek's point, it doesn't help when you just never throw the ball. And you go back to that 2020 season, Minnesota ranked 13th in the Big Ten in passing attempts. In 2021, last season, they ranked dead last. And this season, they are going to end the season dead last in pass attempts, dead last in receiving yards, passing yards, completions. But I keep coming back to this. Why do we think that the passing game, because what was evidently clear to me was that the passing game at some point in that second half was going to have to make a play. There's only so many times Mo Ibrahim can only get 3 or 4 yards before a very, very good Iowa defense eventually figures it out. And because there's so much pressure, to Derek's point, and I agree, that they know that there's limited reps. Minnesota only had 17 dropbacks with their quarterback on Saturday. That means you get 4 opportunities, essentially a quarter. And you already know in the back of your mind, because this has been, it's been a reoccurring theme throughout the entire PJ Fleck tenure, the last 3 years at least. Let me say that. I'll recant my words. The last 3 years, when something goes wrong in the passing game, the head coach just pulls the plug, and then the passing game goes into a shell. And then when they need them to make a moment, like against the Iowa Hawkeyes or against the Purdue Boilermakers or against the Illinois Fighting Illini, because I went back and looked, fellas, at those 3 games specifically this season, 3 very winnable games, 3 games where Minnesota was tied or winning in the second half. The passing game in those 3 games in the second half for Minnesota has 4 interceptions, 0 touchdowns, a 3.9 yards per attempt, which is pathetic, and their quarterback, no matter if it's Ethan or Tanner, is completing 40% of their passes. So why do we – so here's my point, Luke, is maybe you can talk Derek and I off the edge with this, is until PJ just decides that they need to actually – and again, he's going to – you know, the response I'll probably get is, you know, they're working on it in practice, and I'm sure they are. But the difference between a Tuesday practice and Saturday under the lights against Iowa in a tie game, you need to add pressure to the situation. You can't, it's great that you can run it for 400 yards, but to Derek's point, in modern college football, explosive plays have never been more important. And I don't know why we expect anything different at this point, because they've changed. And here's what I say, Luke. In these 3 years where they've been so bad in the passing game since that 19 season, they've changed coordinators. They've changed quarterbacks. Yeah, it's, you don't have Tyler Johnson or Rashad Bateman to bail you out, but they've changed in terms of who's throwing the ball and who's calling the plays. Yet the one constant remains that when the passing game struggles, the head coach pulls the plug, and then we wonder why it doesn't get better when they just don't work on it.
I think one thing that you got to keep in mind too is, at least in those last 3 seasons, you've had Mo, you've had Trey Potts, you know, a positive Trey Potts. You've had, you know, you've had Bucky Irving, you've had Kai Thomas, and you know, they had that big offensive line. They've also been pretty successful at running the ball. And I, you know, we've all banged our heads. I don't know what the right term is. Why the approach is the approach that they take. But the reality is that he can go to his run game, and it's not, it works to a certain
extent. In terms of like philosophically, and that's what and why that bugs me so much now is because, to Derek's point, it's not like PJ Fleck grew up as a Tressel disciple. The issue is the Tressel football in 2022 isn't going to win you the Big Ten West. Now, you could say, Ryan, well, Iowa's about to do it 2 years in a row. Well, to be a Tressel type of team that wins the West, and if you're going to have that offense, you have to be elite on defense. What I would say, Minnesota's got a really good defense, but you also have to have an elite special team, which they don't.
But the other thing is Iowa manufactures explosive plays.
That's exactly where I was going. Luke, I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan, because that's exactly where I was going to go, which was, let's look at Iowa. Okay, so maybe some of this debatable, some of it isn't, but arguably probably more deficient at wide receiver than even Minnesota.
They are.
Definitely, without question, worse in the running game. Not even close. Probably not as good of an offensive line. Definitely not as good at the running back position. So, and then overall as an offense, probably worse at quarterback. I mean, a number of things. So worse at offense, and yet they're able to come up with, in the passing game, multiple explosive plays. So, and part of the answer is because they set them up, they attempted them, they schemed them, they whatever. I mean, they start the game with a well-timed screenplay that you know, they catch Minnesota in a blitz. That ends up being an explosive play. That play that effectively ended the game, that set them up in field goal position, they absolutely set that play action pass up. Minnesota was coming downhill with their safety on the run time and time again. They waited. They kept that play in their back pocket. And on the final drive, they ran play action. They waited until the safety committed, and they hit the tight end behind it for an explosive play with a very deficient offense. So all of this is to say, if Iowa can do it with the worst offense in the Big Ten West, there's no reason why Minnesota can't work something into it, work more of that into it, more attempts into it, more chances.
Yeah, I think in reality, in PJ's tenure here, they haven't been completely void of explosive plays, right? They're able to manufacture some in the run game, obviously. And the reality is, like, Mo is who he is and wasn't able to close those touchdowns. That's not a knock on him. I mean, he is who he is and he's amazing, but he wasn't able to get to the house on those long runs. But also, the reality is like, this isn't 2019. You don't have Rashad Bateman. You don't have Tyler Johnson, who just organically are going to create explosive plays within your system. So this is where you have to become creative, and you have to scheme them up week to week based on tendencies from other defenses. And the reality is that the Gophers either don't do that because they keep running the same basic, you know, system stuff, or they're just unwilling to because PJ is so risk averse, right? And man, at this point, I killed on Jerry Kill and Tracy Clays for being risk averse. At this point, PJ is by far more risk averse than either of those guys.
Well, I think we've heard in some of the press conferences, if you kind of read the tea leaves, that you know, PJ will talk. I'll give you an example. I think it was 2019. Minnesota started the year. They struggled. We all remember. A lot in the non-conference, and running the ball, they were running nothing but inside zone. And somebody asked the question of him at a press conference, why don't you run outside zone? Why don't you run jet sweep? Why don't you mix it up? And his answer was, we're going to run the things that we're good at, or that we have the personnel for, or basically we're going to put ourselves in the best position to be efficient on offense. Don't have any problem at all with that answer. I get that. Later in the year, they started running outside zone. Not sure what changed in practice, but outside zone looked just fine, and it ended up being a huge piece of their offense that year. So he has said himself that if he feels, to Ryan's point about pulling the plug, I mean, this is evidence that if he feels it's not going to be effective or they do something else better, they're just not going to do it. And I think, although that sounds good, I think we're seeing evidence that you have to come up with something. And again, I don't want to paint a black and white picture of, you know, does Minnesota need to start going five wide and throwing the ball down? You're not going to throw the ball downfield against Iowa. I mean, that's not what we're talking about, but we're talking about things like we mentioned, more play action passing, maybe a screen, maybe a middle screen.
Outside of Iowa using their tight ends, a screen in a Minnesota offense? What?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give Iowa too much credit here, but I'll just end with this. At the beginning of the year, this offense couldn't, I mean, it was historically bad, and it still is pretty bad, but it was historically bad. And they kind of sort of found a little bit of a pulse the last few games. Now, this is an argument could be made that maybe they found a little bit of a pulse or they found a little bit of life in the offense because they kept at it. They kept trying to develop it maybe went from a 0 to a 3. It's still not pretty, but the offense, the passing offense that Iowa has now is better than the passing offense that they had in the first half of the season.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, they're not particularly great at running the ball. I know that they had a game or two ago where they had 200 yards rushing. But the reality is, you know, they found where they could potentially have some success. And the fact is, where are you going to manufacture explosive plays? Usually in the passing game. And I'm not saying it's not impossible in the running game. But the reality is their offensive line hasn't been consistent enough. Their running backs have not been consistent enough. And for as much heat as Spencer Petras and Brian Ferentz have taken, like, kudos to those guys. They've found a way, right? They're not phenomenal, but they've done just enough with an absolutely elite defense, and that defense deserves credit. The defense, you know, got the defense put them in position to win this game because their offense wasn't able to manufacture enough, but they manufactured just enough to win this football game, Ryan.
Yep. I think the last thing I'll say offensively here is just, this isn't a one-game issue. Now, is the passing game an issue within this game? Yes. When you needed Minnesota to make a play with the ball back after Mo fumbles, the defense does their part. We'll get to tee time, nearly getting a pick at the 10-yard line on a deflection. We'll get to that on the defensive side of the ball. Defense does their part, forces a punt. And when you finally need the passing game to step up, it's just – a deflection, because Riley Moss is a tremendous player, tips it to Jack Campbell. Jack Campbell never steps out. Should have been a pick six. Refs blow the whistle early. But the point remains, you needed the passing game to make a play in this game, in this second half, and they never did. And it's not just this game, because it's been that way through the entire conference season. Outside of the Michigan State game, this passing game has just been incredibly bad. But it's not just this season. It's last season. It's 2020. Why can't Minnesota get over the Iowa issue? Because they think that they have to play perfect. PJ, and he's afraid to make the mistake, which is why he pulls the plug on something like the passing game. If there is one big wish for me, it's when Mo leaves after the, you know, whether it's after the Wisconsin game, whether it's after the bowl game, when you don't have a bona fide stud running back, and you potentially return Chris Ottman-Bell, Brevin Spanford, again, Dalen Wright, Daniel Jackson. You essentially return your entire receiving core. You have the most talented arm talent quarterback that you've had there probably in my lifetime. Is this finally the year in year 7 where the head coach figures out maybe we need to work on that passing game, especially when you look at the 23 schedule, when you're facing teams like North Carolina, Ohio State, Michigan? You're not going to be able to just ground and pound with your Remington candidate center. And I want to figure out a way that PJ Fleck actually decides that the passing game is worth not immediately pulling the plug on when something goes wrong, because it's been that way for 3 years. And that's, I think it's a big reason why Minnesota is now going to be in year 6 and they haven't won the West.
Yeah, in the end, I do think that there might be something there with the fact that their running game has been so consistent and so good that it turns into a bit of a crutch. So I too am interested to see, you know, effectively that entire offensive line that was there for that 2019 season will be gone with John Michael Schmitz graduating. Axel Rushmeyer should graduate as well. But additionally, you know, Mo Ibrahim will be gone.
Chuck Filiaga too.
Oh, I mean, they're gonna lose some guys. It will be very interesting to see if the philosophy changed. I remember early in the non-conference we thought it changed, but I think the reality of that situation was the fact that those teams were just so bad. That, you know, they were just so bad. And ultimately it's frustrating that it feels like we're having the same conversation that we had last year. But again, hats off to you, Mo Ibrahim. Way to go out on a good note in terms of your last game. Sorry, fumbled, man. That sucked. But in the end, it was a phenomenal effort. The Goal Line Club brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. Ryan, just a reminder, it was cold at that game against Iowa. And the Goal Line Club helps facilitate and bring money to the football program so they can get things like coats for recruits or parents of recruits, because on those cold games you got people coming from places that it's not always cold, Ryan, and that's where the Goal Line Club can help make a difference in recruiting and whatever else it is to make that football program function.
It is, and it's incredibly important. I'll remind you again, 100% of your donation to the Goal Line Club goes directly to the Gopher football program. It doesn't get put into other buckets for other places in Gopher athletics. This is the easiest way to support the Gopher football program. So if you want to learn more, if you had a good time at those previews at Jack's Cafe and you're like, all right, I'm in now, go to goalineclub.org, click on memberships at the top of the page, click on the join now, and you'll be right in.
Okay, let's talk a little bit of defense. So the Gophers ended up giving up 13 points on the day. In reality, you know, like always, the Iowa defense found a way to set up the Iowa offense that turned into a field goal. But ultimately, as well, Iowa's defense should have scored a touchdown. That was an absolutely bogus call. Jack Campbell's not out of bounds. Shouldn't have blown the whistle. Can't believe it didn't get overturned on replay. But regardless, on the day, Iowa was only able to amass 280 yards of total offense, 221 of those through the air. They were 15 of 24. And then rushing, they only rushed for 59 yards. In reality, this came down to, you know, a Gophers defense that seemingly would not give up explosive plays, gave up a couple of key explosive plays, and it started right off the rip, Derek.
Yeah, I this was a interesting game for the defense from the perspective of how aggressive they were against the run and how much they just played coverage against the pass. I mean, it was very clear that was, at least after they got burned on the first screen that we talked about already. I don't know if that was the plan all along or if they threw the plans out the window and decided to play coverage after getting burned on the blitz. We'll never know. But against the run, I mean, as we talked about, Minnesota, they brought a safety down hard. I mean, they were all in on stopping the run. It was full send in run looks, running down in distances, and did pretty well there. You know, the head-scratching thing for me against the pass, and again, I say this fully knowing that the defense held them to 13 points and one could argue 10 points because three, you know, came off of a turnover, which, as you mentioned, Luke, should have been a pick six. But so point wise, it's hard to argue with the outcome, but it was interesting that Minnesota chose to play his coverage on passing down and distances, because as you guys had talked about, Spencer Petras was actually pretty decent when he doesn't have pressure. So he had been fairly successful without pressure. So Minnesota chose not to pressure. The one time they did, they got a sack and it ended up totally changing that drive. But and the other thing though that was more perplexing and I think somewhat inexcusable was, if you're going to play coverage, I don't know how you're not locating the tight end on every play. Iowa, if you've watched, you know, more than half of game of film, they throw to their tight end. And when they're not throwing to their tight end, they're trying to throw to their tight end. That's what they do. And I'll give them some credit. They're creative about the way they try and get their tight ends open. That's what offenses do, and they're pretty good with it. But, you know, the number of times they lost the tight end, as Ryan said, was, to me, it's inexcusable. I mean, this is a limited Iowa offense that doesn't do very many things well. So if you're not going to pressure the quarterback, I don't know how you don't limit. I don't know how you're not locating the tight end.
Like, think about the first play of the game where Sam Laporta, their tight end, is a good player. He's their leading receiver in about every category. They go with a little bit of motion, and Mariano Sorimarin gets caught taking the cheese. I don't know what he's looking at, because Flip Dixon's got the running back. Tyler Newbin's got the motion man. Cody Lindenberg is coming off the other side on a run blitz. There's no one else to cover Sam Laporta, not named 55. And there is, you know, the funniest part about it is I'm watching it on the GIF rewind. The left guard is now he's got to be 20 yards down the field. He's looking actively to block someone, and there is no one there. And that's how you give up 58 yards. Again, you look at that fourth down conversion. Braylon Oliver has the most immobile quarterback in the entire Big Ten, dead to rights. He is unblocked on fourth and two, and he misses the tackle. And then I wish I could say that's the first time that's happened for that young man, and it's unfortunate because I think he gets injured on that play after he misses the tackle. But it's just, if you just make that play, that one right there, where you have the most immobile quarterback in the entire Big Ten, dead to rights, and you miss the sack, if you just get the sack there, your offense takes over it. I think their own 45. Iowa doesn't get any points. Iowa ends up scoring on this drive. Missed opportunity. I mean, Derek's point, that final explosive play for Iowa to their tight end, Jordan Howden bites incredibly hard. Tight end runs free. On the day, Iowa tight ends have 10 catches for 178 yards. That's not nearly 18 yards per reception. And it's not like Iowa targeting the tight end is anything new in my entire lifetime. I just don't understand how Minnesota couldn't locate the tight end from the first play to the last play. It's inexcusable to me. But the other thing I want to note here now, Luke, is I think I told Derek when I found this stat earlier today, but in Iowa versus PJ Fleck games in the first quarter, we have six quarters of data. What do you think the scoring margin is between Iowa and Minnesota in six first quarter games coached by PJ Fleck teams?
I'm going to guess it's like 60 points. I mean,
it is Iowa 54, Minnesota 10.
Yeah, I was going to say it's really high. I remember the 2019 game, they got out to a huge start in that first quarter. It's not good, Bob.
Like, if there's going to be one wart we're going to talk about for a Joe Rossi defense this year, and again, this is a defense that statistically is top 10, if not top, well, I'd say they're top 15 in every category statistically, if not top 10. Again, this is a really, really, really good defense. But if we're going to say that there's a wart, it's issues in the first quarter of games. You look at this Iowa game, they led up 10. You look at the Nebraska game, they're down immediately. You look at the Purdue and the Illinois game, opening drive scores. And for an offense that refuses to pass the ball, when you're playing in a negative game script, it certainly doesn't help you, Derek.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to add one more thing to harp on it for one more second. You know, limiting the tight end, I just want to be clear. Joe Rossi and his defense absolutely has the capability of limiting a position or a player if they choose to do it. I mean, this is a defense or a defensive scheme that shut down Rondale Moore, who nobody else could do that. And so if they scheme for it, if that had been part of the plan that we're going to take Iowa's tight ends out of the passing game, I'm not saying they would have gotten zero catches, but if that had been the plan, I have 100% faith that they would have accomplished that because they've shown it before. So I don't think it was a matter of, well, they tried to do it and weren't able to do it. It just wasn't part of the game plan, which is the part that's a head scratcher for me.
Yeah, I think too that we can't overlook the fact that Sam Laporta was having an awesome game and then went out with an injury, right?
Left at the end of the first quarter.
Yeah.
And yet Iowa tight ends still killed them.
Yes.
And peace and love to Iowa tight end recruiting. I'm not exactly watching Rob Gronkowski come through that door. Now, peace and love to Ned. I think it's Luke Lachey, among others there. But like the inability to cover the tight end there. Well, the other part of that issue that goes hand in hand with it, Luke, is we talked about it on the preview episode. When Spencer Petras is not under pressure, he's been an incredibly competent quarterback, and he played exactly to what the stats said he would. He completed 64% of his passes. I mean, that's what he had done. I will remind you, if you did not listen to the preview episode, when Spencer Petras coming into this game via the Pro Football Focus definition of pressure had been under pressure this year, he had 4 picks to 1 touchdown, was completing 36% of his passes. When he was not under pressure, he had been completing 64% of his passes, 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. So he had been an incredibly competent quarterback when he'd been kept clean. And that was the other big issue, was where was the pressure?
Yeah,
they had been generating pressure with 4 in the previous games, and this is not a good Iowa offensive line. They had allowed the second most pressures in the entire Big Ten, not named Nebraska. Spencer Petras, now there was some quick passing game. I will absolutely note that. But the only sack on the day comes from Terrell Smith on a corner blitz. No one gets home organically on 4. So why does Spencer Petras look a lot better than what people have seen in previous games where Iowa gets blown out? Because Minnesota couldn't get pressure with 4. And that's been another issue this season, and it's why Minnesota's dead last in the Big Ten West in pressures.
And but also to say, Ryan, it's another one of the reasons they lost the turnover battle. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get to that, but you don't force turnovers generally if you're never going to bring pressure. I mean, yes, the quarterback can make a mistake, a safety can jump a route, but by and large, Iowa, when they've turned the ball over, it's absolutely been when the quarterback's under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to give him credit on the explosive plays. One thing that I thought Derek, you astutely pointed out, especially early, it felt like, you know, the approach, it felt like I wasn't going to be able to run the ball, right? So they were definitely trying to get explosive plays and generate them manufacture them, right? Because ultimately they felt like they needed to score. There was something they knew. It felt like Ferentz and staff knew, right?
Well, at the end of the I think so. If you've been a long time Gopher fan and watched, you know, this long reign of Kirk Ferentz and seen him coach games, he coaches to the game. He changes his strategy very widely depending on how he feels the game is going to flow. And when he tipped his hand was at the end of the first half. When Iowa got the ball and had every reason in the world to sit on the ball because they were, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they were getting the ball coming out of the second half. Okay. And with a very anemic passing offense, they wanted points. I mean, they were going after it. So that told me right there that their head coach saw something in this game that made him believe. And maybe it was that second quarter drive that we talked about that Minnesota looked so efficient on, that they felt like they needed more points.
Yeah.
That he absolutely would not do that if he didn't feel like they needed more points.
Yeah, and it was really 2 second quarter drives, right? You know, the 9-play 72-yard touchdown, and then the 11 play 73-yard missed field goal, right? On the missed field goal, that's the one where ultimately they miss Brevin Spanford, which could have easily been a touchdown, right? And then Trickett ends up missing the field goal. But yeah, I thought that was an astute observation because they definitely were going for points, and they went from it from the clip or from the rip. Like they were trying to manufacture explosive plays because they knew they needed to score. And the reality is too, like this Minnesota team has struggled when they have to play from behind. And you know, when you give up that early touchdown, which this Joe Rossi defense has done a handful of times this year, it has made things all the more difficult.
Well, when you lose the turnover battle like they did, I just keep coming back to 2 plays where it's Braylon Oliver missing a clean shot at Spencer Petras to get a turnover on downs. He misses it. It's a completion. Iowa gets 7. And then at the end of the game, and again, it's tough to put a ton on him, but it's just if Terrell Smith gets his head up, it might be a pick 6. I mean, I have the play in the GIF rewind if people want to see it. The Petras pass is errant. It deflects right into his face. He gets his hands up, gets both hands on the ball, and he can't corral it in. Can you imagine how big that would have been if he could just catch the ball? Minnesota has it then first and goal at the Iowa 9 with what would it have been? Had to have been like 3 minutes left, 4 minutes left.
Yeah, I mean, he likely catches it right on the 9 or the 10. I don't think he probably gets in because number 4 is right there. He
probably
there.
Does not. But, you know, the point being, like, how many times have we seen an Iowa guy make that play?
But,
you know, it's just it hits you right between. Again, it's a deflection. It's a reactionary play. I'm not saying it was gifted immediately to him. But when you get both hands on the ball, man,
you got to make it.
They needed the defense at some point in that second half, even for as well as they played, because I feel like we're just, you know, ripping the defense after those first two scoring drives. Again, they allowed 3 points the rest of the game. Mm-hmm. They forced, I think, 6 straight punts in that second and third quarter. Like, they played well. This is not a good offense for Iowa, but they still played well. It's just you needed them to be really good. They were good. But being able to force a turnover with either that Oliver blitz or that Terrell Smith deflection would have changed the entire course of the game, and then you lose the turnover battle by 2. That's how it happened.
Yeah, and the Terrell Smith play. The other one is on the Terrell Smith sack too. You know, if you could have turned that into a strip sack of something, that would have been phenomenal.
Petras gets his head around literally at the last moment, or else he might just be blindsided there.
Yeah.
But again, it's just you needed the defense to make a play, and they made some, but they needed to make that big play, that, you know, that Justin Wally type of interception against Wisconsin in the second half.
Mm-hmm.
And they never got it.
Yeah. And the reality is that Iowa did get them, right? Like, Riley Moss gets his hand in there, pops that ball up, and Jack Campbell's able to make the interception. Should have been a touchdown. And then additionally, you know, the Mo fumble, you know, Mo's trying to stretch, and they knock it out, and they make the big plays when they're needed. That's the thing that's frustrating, is it can come down to just a couple plays. And, you know, when you're Minnesota and you can't manufacture, explosive plays, your margin for error is much thinner. And, you know, we saw that this Saturday, and kudos to Iowa for making the plays. They did, even though if you look at it statistically, they got absolutely hammered in the run game. They bend but didn't break, and made the big plays when they needed to, when they counted the most.
Forced 2 turnovers within their own, you know, with their back up against the wall, one within their own 15, another within their own, I think it was 30 on that Riley Moss interception. To your point, again, there isn't just one bucket we're going to put all the blame in. There's a lot to put into, but it's Iowa. You know, they made the plays defensively when they needed to. It's why Iowa is now one win away from going back to Indianapolis, is because they're elite on defense and special teams to compensate for an incredibly sad offense. But when you're absolutely in that elite tier, like they are in those two categories, that's how you can get away with things like that. They come away with those untimely or very timely plays year after year after year, and they did it again on Saturday.
All right, Derek, any final thoughts here on defense?
Well, I've got some more thoughts on the game as a whole, but not on defense.
Legacy Life and Law brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio, helping clients with the most important decisions in their life for the most important people in their lives at the most important times of their life, Ryan. So, Ryan, the reality of the situation is we all are going to have unexpected things in our lives come up. Legacy Life and Law can help you get a solid footing on many of those big life issues, whether that's buying a home, whether that's, you know, some sort of estate plan, etc. Need to get your stuff in place. I hope your buddy has called Legacy Life and Law.
If you're tired of me scolding you, the listener, like I do my best man each and every week, then go to legacyandlifelaw.com/GGR. You'll be directed where you can get a will. You can get an estate plan. The things that you need to take care of your loved ones if something happens are important. You're an adult. I don't need to be scolding you like you're my 12-year-old son somewhere. So go to legacyandlife.com/GGR and figure out your plan today.
Okay. Okay, we got to talk a little bit of special teams here, and then we'll talk kind of the game theory, coaching decisions, etc. But Ryan, I think this is, you know, we often give you the soapbox in which you very proudly stand on and spout your frustrations about special
teams. It's not even proud. It's just
it's a brand you have.
I don't understand the apathy, but go for it.
I get it too. Here's my frustration. What on earth are we doing in like punt return situations? Like, what is Quentin Redding
doing?
Don't
enjoy lining up 65 yards from where Torrey Taylor punched the football, Luke?
Like, oh my goodness. I couldn't for the life of me understand what on earth they were doing on those punt return situations. Like kick return, whatever, it was fine. But like, my goodness, that was just mind numbing and, you know, arguably could have cost him the game, but then they go, you know, and maybe did, like, maybe if he doesn't have that, we don't have the mo fumble, right? Like, goodness gracious. It was just, I just don't know what they're coaching up there. I can't even fathom what it is. And I'm just so frustrated. And then Mark Crawford, I mean, he is what he is.
We knew it was a mismatch, and it's just, here's where I'm at is I just won't hear it anymore. If you think Gopher special teams are fine, I can't even with you. I can't because when PJ Fleck wants to play trestle ball, look at the Iowa model. If you're going to be one dimensional in offense, I'd argue Minnesota has a better offense than Iowa, but Iowa's defense is in that elite tier. Minnesota's is in the very good tier. And then special teams, Iowa's is insane. They're fantastic. It's why they can get away with not having a good offense. And Minnesota's is incredibly mediocre, and it can the field position game was going to be won. Anytime you ever play a Kirk Ferentz Iowa team, field position is going to be a gigantic part of the game, especially when the weather was what it was. Minnesota got killed in the field position game. The Iowa average starting field position was their own 32. Minnesota's was their own 21. And you're thinking to yourself, well, Ryan, that seems pretty arbitrary. In a game where both top 10 defenses, 10 yards of average starting field position is massive. You look at the punting game for both teams. The Iowa Hawkeyes averaged 42.4 net yards per punt. Minnesota averaged 31. You gave up over 11 yards per punt. Torrey Taylor pins, he has four punts inside the 15, including two inside the Minnesota 5. Mark Crawford has zero inside the Iowa 20. Punt return, I just don't even know what to think anymore. I cannot explain to people why, and I watched this back, I saw it live, and I was like, I can't be seeing this right. So I go back, rewatch the game. That one where Quentin Redding literally, for some reason, fields the punt at the 3-yard line when that thing is clearly bouncing to the end zone. He is lined up.
Mark Crawford couldn't know where he was, right? That had to be what it was.
It's inexplicable because it's game 11 for him as the punt returner. Like,
yeah, but
there is no explanation that I can hear that. And why this irritates me is because Torrey Taylor punts that football where he connects with it on his foot is the Iowa 30. And then you watch it on the replay. Quentin Redding is standing at like the Minnesota 5 or 10. Why is Minnesota have their guy 60 yards deep from a punt?
And you
don't tell me he's going to run up on it because we all know he's not.
Well, if he does run up on it, he better run up on it like 10 yards to catch it. Yeah, and he doesn't even, he runs backwards.
60 yards deep. I just don't understand that. Again, Iowa gets 16 yards of field position with their punt return game. Minnesota gets zero. I'd argue it shouldn't be negative because Redding fields that football. And then Matthew Trickett, I feel for the kid because, again, it's not fully on him.
I have a question, though, on that one. How was the wind on that one?
Well, you asked Justin Gard. He would tell you it was non-existent on the field. I know that comment has really upset some people that were in the stands. And I could see in the press box that wind was whipping through the end zone, at least where the flags were. Now, again,
there's a difference
looked like it affected Drew Stevens when he was kicking field goals on that side from that distance, did it?
Yeah, well, that's fair.
I feel for Trickett because he's only missed two kicks all season.
They've been huge.
But the two missed kicks are catastrophic swings in win probability. Missing that chippy, that 28-yarder against Purdue killed them. And then missing, I will call, a 34-yard field goal, regardless of collegiate or NFL, especially with the wind at your back, that has to be a make. It has to be. In a game like this, you can't come away with no points there, and he pushes it right. Now, you can say it was the wind. I can say he should know what the wind was doing. Again,
the line wasn't good.
You can't miss that field goal. So let's go through it. Iowa's field goal game was better. Iowa's punting game was better. Iowa's return game was better. That's why you lose 11 yards of field position. Iowa hits their field goals. Minnesota doesn't. Iowa gets a jolt in the return game. Minnesota doesn't. If you're going to play trestle football, that you have to have good special teams. Minnesota doesn't even have average special teams.
And they have a dedicated special teams coach, which is the thing that just
ticks me off. I know no one wants to hear about it anymore. Everybody is so apathetic to it, and that bugs the crap out of me, because why are so many people just – you can't play the way PJ Fleck wants to play 60 minutes of a football game and have mediocre special teams. And to Luke's point, you have a special teams coordinator who – that's all he does. He's got top 25 special teams coordinator money in the country. And when was the last time Minnesota blocked a kick? When was the last time they blocked a punt? When was the last time they set up a punt return for Quentin Redding? They don't try to block it. They don't try to return it. I don't know why they're so convinced that somebody's going to try a fake punt on them. It never happens. It's just I am always upset about special teams, because it seems like this fan base is apathetic about it, and I don't for the life of me understand why. I understand there's only a handful of plays a game. Again, we're talking 5 to 10 plays. But watch that football game back and tell me that those 5 to 10 plays didn't swing that pendulum that was teetering on either side towards the Iowa Hawkeyes.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about some of the coaching decisions. The sigh probably says enough. Yeah, Derek, I'm not even going to give you a question. Where do you want to take this, man? Like, there are so many directions we could take this.
How about, the coaching decision specifically? I think Ryan has a good perspective on that. Maybe he can take that. I wanted to just talk about philosophy at the end a little bit, and just maybe what our takeaways are from this game, because I think that's part of the reason why we keep seeing this same song played every year is maybe it's not the right takeaways, but so if I can get 2 minutes on that at the end, I would appreciate it. But Ryan, coaching decisions, I think you, when I've talked with you about it, I think you're dialed in on those.
Well, I mean, which one do you want to go down the rabbit hole of, Luke, that we haven't already?
I mean, I think we've gone down most of them. For me, the fourth and one.
Which one?
The fourth and one where you have the missed kick. You don't have the timeout, though. That's not the one.
Well, that's the thing is, I will continue to die on the hill that if you have a timeout there and you don't burn it because you only had 10 guys on defense, or you don't burn it because you had to think about potentially going for a fourth and one earlier. I mean, what are we like? You had fourth and one at the Minnesota 38. Like, in what world is anyone asking you to go for that? It's in the first quarter, I believe. Yeah. It's in the first quarter. You should absolutely punt that football. Now, if it's in the fourth quarter and it's a different situation, but you're playing field position. I don't know why he felt the need to take a timeout there. If you have any of those timeouts back, I think it's played a lot differently in that final minute sequence before half. And I will continue to say, imagine if Minnesota just gets points there. It's tied at halftime, and then they come out the second half and they kick a field goal. Imagine how the play calling difference might be for Iowa if they're losing 13-10 versus tie game.
Yeah.
Again, hindsight's always 20/20. I get that, but the timeout usage is an issue. It is, and we all know it. We've all talked about it. It's just, how does the head coach in a game like this where he gets so spun up, because I can assure you he is well aware. No one has to tell him or tweet him or email him that he's 0-6 against the Iowa Hawkeyes. He's well aware. This entire coaching staff is well aware. And I just wish you wouldn't get so spun up in games like this, where if you just relax and you coach like you normally do and you don't burn three timeouts in the first 20 minutes of the game, So,
all right, let's get into like general philosophy. So, Derek, I'm going to start with you on the general philosophy, and I'm going to pose a question first and foremost. PJ Fleck, no hat. Kirk Ferentz, hat. Very cold. What were your thoughts?
Well, there was a lot of commentary around that, which was interesting.
I thought that was hilarious as well.
Whatever, I don't know if that was a mentality thing or what, but whatever works, I guess. But here's, thanks for allowing me just a couple seconds on philosophy. I'm going to stick my neck out a little bit, and I'm probably not going to make many friends with this comment, but we've seen, certainly after this game, and I think after other games, comments along the line of, well, here's what happened, offense, defense, special teams, whatever. But the bottom line is, if you just take away these two or three mistakes, in this case, if you take away those two turnovers, Minnesota probably wins the game. Again, here's the problem I have with that. Technically, of course, that's true. But I just don't know that that is, and you hear coaches say that, by the way, all the time. They get up on the podium and they say, well, there's two or three plays there that really hurt us. If you take those away, we're right there. I don't know that that's the lesson we should be taking away from this. I mean, I think what's important here, and let's just talk about the Iowa games in particular, are what are the lessons we're taking away from this, and what are we going to change moving forward to give us a better chance to win? Or
I'm just going to interject here for a second. Yep. It's almost like it's not what are we taking away. It's what do we hope that PJ Fleck is taking away from these?
Well, let me interject there, because this has been my frustration with PJ Fleck and his tenure, right? He's got a lot of these mantras. He is the modern day coach, right? He's able to connect with student athletes on like a different level than others have been able to do, etc. He's more of the, the CEO type of coach that most of these, he can fundraise and the whole nine yards. He has a mantra that bugs me to no end, and it is change your best. And he has been unwilling to change. He additionally says that failure is growth, which I'm a firm believer in. It's something I talk about with my guys at work all the time. It's okay to make mistakes. We got to learn from them, and then we can't make them again. And the reality is he continues to do the same thing over and over. He doesn't change his best, and it feels disingenuous, Derek. And I think that's somewhat to the line you're going on.
Yeah, that's where I'm going with it. And to complete the thought, first of all, yes, failing is our greatest teacher in anything in life. I mean, that's how you improve. You identify your failings, you work to improve them, etc. So in this case, when you talk about limiting mistakes, avoiding mistakes, whatever, that's what practice is for. That's what you work on fundamentals. That's where you do correction. That's what film study is. But football in general is just a game of mistakes. So you can put out the stats that the team that makes less mistakes is the team that usually wins, and all of that is true. But I personally am not convinced that chasing the perfect game is a good strategy.
Especially against the Iowa Hawkeyes.
Well, yeah. I think we would submit as evidence the last six games. In a way, and I know I'll probably be knocked for this analogy, but it's kind of like saying, if this were baseball, well, if we just gave up less hits, we'd win the game. Or if this were basketball, and you'd say, well, if we just miss less baskets, we'd win the game. Well, of course, if you can play a football game and have no mistakes, you're probably going to win the game. And there's no reason why you shouldn't strive for that. And again, that's what practice is for. But there's something to be said about winning the game and putting together in today's generation of football, in this era. I'll just say one more time, on offense, You need a mixture of consistency and big plays. And I would argue that in this era of football, much more than the Jim Tressel era and much more than the era before Jim Tressel, big plays, explosive plays have never been more important. So there's a reason why 50 years ago, every single team ran the triple option. It wasn't a game of speed. It was a game of attrition and ball control. And you hope to win the game 6-3. And that era of football is no longer. There's a reason why only the service academies run the triple option now. It's been completely abandoned. I'm using an extreme example, but we've outlined it. We've submitted our opinions, and I'll end by saying I hope that we take the opportunity, or that in Ryan's point, the coaching staff takes the opportunity to look at maybe a change in philosophy or a change in approach on offense. Doesn't mean you have to throw out all your ideals. Doesn't mean you have to coach them differently in practice. It doesn't mean that limiting mistakes isn't important. But I think it's worth looking at, because I think when you rush for 300 yards, 300 and some yards, and control the line of scrimmage and control the time of possession and have all those things, and you still find a way to lose game after game, year after year, I think you should look at a different approach.
All right. So one thing I kind of want to get back into perspective, I hear fans and they're mad. And I think that's actually a good thing, because I think about where I've come as a Gopher fan through my life. There was not a lot of buzz around this program. There weren't a lot of people, you know, into it and following closely. I still think that, you know, 2019 was an absolute amazing season. I still think that there is more interest and buzz around this program than there ever is. And I think people being mad is good, because they're not as apathetic as they once were. And I think we also have to put this into perspective. Like, as frustrated as we are with losing 6 in a row to Iowa, PJ has absolutely risen the floor of this program. Now the question becomes, can he raise the ceiling, right? Can he get them to a point where they exceed some, or they meet some sort of championship? There's no question, the data is there. He's currently 25-26 in Big Ten games. I'm not looking at non-conference games. That's the best a coach has been. Well, if Tracy Clays would be the closest, but since really Glenn Mason in this era, Glenn Mason, I think his winning percentage was about 400. I have the stats somewhere. I don't have it, so I'm going off the top of my head. I'm not as good as you, Ryan. You have this ability to like retain stats like crazy.
That's why I was so good at tests.
Yeah.
I have an ability to look at a stat once.
Yeah.
Like, if you've ever read a practice report that I've written on Gopher Illustrated, I don't take notes.
I realize this.
I just watch it and I remember it. And again, it's, I guess, me being able to be young and having a memory still.
Yeah. And in the end, you know, PJ has absolutely brought some sustained success. Now, you know, the first 2 years were tough. They had a 200 some winning percentage. I think he was 5-13 in his first 2 years. Now he's been something like, I don't know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but they're closer to like a 600 winning percentage now in Big Ten games. Like, he's in his own tier from a coaching perspective. Now, I get that next season, you know, they're going to have a really tough schedule, and people say that this season, you know, is a huge missed opportunity. It was. It's absolutely a huge missed opportunity, and they absolutely needs to take some heat from that. Because I thought Phil Mackey had a tweet that was really good, where he said that, you know, the shine has come off PJ a little bit. I don't think that means that, I don't think he's trying to insinuate that PJ can't do it, but I think the honeymoon's over. I think the honeymoon from the 2019 season is over. And frankly, he's got to find a way to reinvent himself. He's got to find a way to recruit some wide receivers. He's got to fill some gaps. He's got to change philosophy, etc., because he needs to continue to be successful. And this is an absolute challenge, and I'm still in his corner, and I hope that people are still in his corner, because I haven't seen success like this, Ryan, in my 10 years ago for fan.
So I just looked up, to your point, since that 2019 season, so we're talking about 9 conference games, 7 conference games in 20, 9-21, and 8-22 so far. PJ Fleck is 20-13 in his last 33 conference games. That is a 60% winning percentage. So it's at a point that I would say is above kill. It's at a point that
significantly above kill. Yeah.
But there's still a lot of meat left on the bone. And I can already tell you that my beloved Pair and a Spare podcaster, Chip Scoggins, and I are going to have some disagreements.
You mean the guy who likes Tennessee, whose team, you know, has their best outing in 20 years? And then,
rest in peace, Hendon Hooker.
Yeah.
Now out for the season with an ACL tear.
And not to mention, gets absolutely slaughtered by South Carolina in arguably like one of the, I don't know. Okay. I'm not going to bash the SEC, but they're very weak.
We can get into that later, but it's more so like, you know, one of the comments he made was comparing Fleck to Mason, but you can't do that recruiting wise. Cause what recruiting was 25 years ago or 20 years ago, compared to this day and age, as someone who lives and breathes recruiting every single day of his life, you can't compare eras. I mean, you can't even look 5 years in the past at what was important then, to let alone compare the challenges that PJ has in recruiting compared to what Glenn Mason did. The Big Ten West has never recruited as well as they have in my opinion, in what they have the last few years. Purdue wasn't recruiting as well as they were 20 years ago. Iowa, Wisconsin, Northwestern, Nebraska. Again, Nebraska's got millions upon millions of dollars of NIL money to spend. It's never about talent down there. They didn't have, again, we can say what it was, you know, 20 years ago. So it's just like, yes, I understand that apathy is good for no one, especially me. Again, my entire livelihood is based on the Gopher football team. I'm well aware. Trust me. No one understands that more than me. But to your point, Luke, it just comes down to, you're going to end year six here without a Big Ten West title. You're probably not going to get it next year when you look at that schedule. It's, you just, the evolution of PJ Fleck, if it's going to continue here for another 5 years, has to be on offense. And it has to be, you have to find a way to find rhythm in a passing game so that when you need it in key moments in very winnable games, like like Purdue, like Illinois, and like Iowa, that you have something to go to. And it just, it needs to evolve here in the offseason with the passing game. Yes, it's about talent, but it's also just about philosophical. You know, that's what it is. So it's just, I'm with you, Luke. I'm with you.
And don't you find it ironic, guys, that, do you remember, I think we did, I think, Derek, you were recording with us then, but that Illinois breakdown where they just absolutely got mowed over, right? And we basically said, like, okay, well, if this PJ Fleck era is going to work out, they got to find the defensive coordinator, and you know, they have to do something. And now here we are saying, like, they got to figure it out on offense.
Well, and maybe there's a silver lining there in that PJ is identified in that case, part of, maybe someone argues, it took him a little bit, but he identified what needed to be done and he addressed it and look what happened. So I would just say my two cents here. Yeah, I've talked long enough on this podcast, but Ryan, I don't think it's your opinion. I think it's factual that the Big Ten West has never recruited better. And I would just add that I've said this in many different forms in the past. There is nothing like trying to reshuffle the deck in college football. It is just incredibly difficult. And, you know, I kind of mock the pro leagues and say, if you want to have a good pro team, all you have to do is just be bad long enough, because you're going to get draft picks, you're going to get scheduling favors, there are so many parity rules in pros that it goes round and round. Dynasties are just hard to come by. But look at college. I mean, it is so difficult to take a, you know, whatever tier you want to put it at school and move them up a tier or move them up two tiers and sustain it. It is incredibly difficult. So while, you know, I've been critical and, you know, I fully acknowledge that this is a really tough task. It's a tough thing to do. And PJ Fleck and his staff, they run a clean program. They are in a good spot, and you know, it's. I want to acknowledge that. Make sure I'm clear on that too.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Ultimately, you know, from a philosophy perspective, you know, a lot is going to have to change. This era is going to close. The Mo Ibrahim era is going to close, and it's going to be interesting to see how PJ evolves with it. He has been able to make tough decisions by moving on from Mike Sanford, from moving on from Rob Smith. Thank goodness he moved on from Rob Smith. And this will be probably what defines the remainder of his tenure here, if he can improve his offensive philosophy going forward.
The
Burns Insurance Agency brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. Ryan, again, it's that season where we're thinking about health insurance. Maybe people are going to be changing that. Why not think about changing the coverage on your home, your snowmobile, your ATV, your commercial real estate, your car, whatever it might be? Give the good folks, specifically Bill at Insurance by Burns, a call today.
Well, the nice thing about it is just this past week, he saved the lovely couple. They switched their home and their auto insurance to him. He saved them $1,500. I'm not talking about these are some luxury millionaires. These are Joe Schmoes like you and me, Luke. He saved them $1,500 annually by switching their home and auto to the Burns Insurance Agency. So if that's piqued your interest, I'll remind you, he is licensed as an independent insurance agent in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, New York, Florida, and Utah. And to get in contact with him, go to insurancebyburns.com or email him at bill@insurancebyburns.com.
Okay, let's talk a little bit around the Big Ten. I want to highlight, guys, real quickly, this was a phenomenal weekend in the Big Ten, like the Big Ten West in general, too. And I want to just like make sure we acknowledge, like, I think the Big Ten West gets dumped on a lot. And while I am biased because Minnesota plays in the league, I don't think that I should be. Like, I think people don't really understand how fun it can be when there can be parity. Derek, I mean, you played, right? Well,
yeah, and I think the early slate of games were just wild. I mean, it was just fun, and I'm by judging, you know, watching on television, which may or may not be accurate, I really felt like the weather played a factor in many of those early games, which if we want to just briefly get into the, you know, Big Ten versus SEC versus other, that's a huge difference. I mean, playing games in November in very inclement weather is going to tighten games up. I mean, we'll talk about it, but Ohio State and Michigan and all these others, you know, where you saw definitely plenty of fans outside of the Big Ten kind of bagging on Michigan and trying to bag on Ohio State. And it's like, wait a minute, these games are being played in 25 degrees and 20 mile an hour wind. And so it made for a wild, particularly the first early set of games.
Yeah. And I actually love the parody. It made a lot of these games very interesting. Additionally, to your point, Derek, with the weather, it changes how you construct a roster as well, right? You have to think about the weather long-term in your approach. You have to be much more, you have to be much more balanced and, you know, in terms of what you're able to do, because there might be games that you just can't throw. You think to that Northwestern Ohio State game, you know, Ohio State had to run the football. So let's start with the games that weren't particularly close and then look at those games that that were particularly close and pretty interesting. So first and foremost, Penn State wins 55-10 over Rutgers, moving to 9-2, 6-2 in the Big Ten. Sean Clifford again had not like an amazing game. He was 17-26. Their running game, Ryan, continues to be strong, and that's really what they've been able to hang their hat on.
It's so good. It's got Luke choked up a little bit over
Jeez,
there.
I'm coughing like crazy, and I can't mute enough, and I'm sorry, everyone.
Well, here's what I'll continue to say is Penn State doesn't get enough love nationally. Against teams that haven't been Michigan or Ohio State, they have won their average games by, it's got to be 30 points now. And I'm not speaking in hyperbole. I believe it is like 29, 30 points. They have eviscerated everybody. And it's okay that they're not in that top tier. It's okay, because those two teams in Michigan and Ohio State should be playing in the college football playoff here in a couple weeks. But I will continue to say this Penn State team is really good. They're not elite, but they're really good. And for a team that's probably looking at the Rose Bowl or the Orange Bowl, this was definitely a bounce back season for what that Penn State and James Franklin team needed.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Ohio State Maryland. This is a game that they win 43-30, setting up an 11-0 season, 8-0 in the Big Ten, as they're going to meet Michigan here to settle who's going to win the West. This game was a lot closer than the score indicated. It took a late touchdown by the defense, Derek. But again, you know, signs of life from Maryland in Tungavailoa came back and had a pretty nice game, had a terrible turnover to end the game, but ultimately, like, I was really impressed with what Maryland was able to accomplish in this one.
Yeah, it was a one-score game for most of the game. I mean, up until that last touchdown was in the final moments. So it was a one-score game that whole time. And this is one of the games where the Big Ten was getting plenty of shade nationally for, you know, why is it so close? I mean, what I can say is Maryland continues to be, they will go as Leah goes. I mean, when he has such a very high ceiling that when he's on and playing well, it doesn't matter who the competition is, they're going to be competitive. But in other games where, for whatever reason, if he's not on and you know, the Maryland tends is one of a couple teams in the Big Ten, Michigan State also comes to mind, that they're just very up and down week to week. So I wouldn't want to play Maryland just because of the fact that if you get them on the wrong week, they just proved it. They have a opportunity to go toe to toe with anybody, but ultimately Ohio State did enough to win.
All right, let's talk about the Northwestern Purdue game. Purdue wins 17-9 in this one. Again, Northwestern, is able to kind of hang around in a game they probably shouldn't be able to hang around in. But Purdue ends up moving to 7-4, 5-3 in the Big Ten. I still think they have an opportunity to, you know, to win the Big Ten here, Ryan. I think you probably have a better pulse on this, but you know, in the end, Purdue found a way when they needed to.
Yeah, if Iowa wins against Nebraska, Iowa's in the Big Ten championship game. And that's where it gets a little bit more interesting. If Nebraska wins, I mean, that's what Purdue's going to be hoping for here. It's just, again, Northwestern is dreadful. Purdue in what was not a clean contest in terms of the wind and the weather, and playing Northwestern makes everybody all types of frazzled. Like, it was not a pretty game. I mean, neither team went for over 300 total yards in this one. That's why it's a one possession game at the end of it. But Purdue does enough, and Purdue gets their fifth conference victory.
All right, so let's get to the really tight games on the day. Illinois has Chase Brown play in this game, which to me was surprising.
Remarkable.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He had 29 carries for 140 yards and two touchdowns. He looked great given what we saw, you know, the game before where he went off gimpy to end that game, and frankly, masterful job by Harbaugh here to end up winning the game. I thought they were dead in the water, and they were able to get a defensive stop and get that late field goal. But Derek, this was a really entertaining football game all in all.
Yeah, really fun game, and I like many others, had already had the funeral for, the Illinois running back season, you know, and thinking it was over, and he goes out at the end of the game and the previous week, and we think it's all over. Instead, he plays, looks phenomenal. They did throttle him quite a bit, but when he was in there, I mean, Chase Brown looked fantastic. And then just to flip the script, Michigan's running back Corum goes out, and that was a huge factor because, you know, Illinois has a very good defense, as we know intimately. So taking him out of the game, really, those two things, I mean, Chase Brown playing and then Blake Corum going out with an injury, really flipped this thing on its head. But the thing that I would just wanted to mention that was really, really stood out to me was Michigan is down 4 with 3 minutes to go, and they chose to kick a field goal, and they were in fairly close. So they don't take a shot. It's 4th and fairly long, I believe. But boy, what a masterpiece. Whatever you think of Harbaugh, I'm kind of neutral on him. I know he's a polarizing guy, but masterpiece to be able to kick the field goal with 3 minutes left, come back, stop Illinois, get the ball back, drive down again, and kick the game-winning field goal. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, there were some calls.
You saw Bielema's comments after the game. He went berserk. I haven't seen the play. I don't know if either one of you two have, but I know he was not happy with.
Yeah, it's a pick play. It's something you got to call.
So it wasn't the refs bailing out a college football playoff contender.
I mean, I don't know. It's tough. Like, I can see where you could make the argument if you're Michigan, but in the same way, it's like if we're going to make things fair for defense, especially if you're going to play press man, like, you got to call that a pick. I mean, he blatantly pushes him. So I don't know what your thoughts were, Derek, on that.
Yeah, I think there's a case to be made. I mean, Illinois is a couple weeks in a row now that they've gotten themselves into trouble, let's say, by just that's their identity now is playing press man across the field. And whether it's screens or, you know, in this, you know, in this case, rub routes, pick routes, they went back to it several times, as a matter of fact, on key plays, and it wasn't called.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the Wisconsin-Nebraska game. Wisconsin finds a way late. They scored 12 points in the fourth quarter to come back and win. They were down 14-3 going into that final frame, and they went 15-14. Casey Thompson did return for Nebraska. Nebraska definitely looked better. This Wisconsin offense is phenomenal. I think I saw that Nebraska, looking at this real quick, yeah, they had 171 yards of total offense. This Wisconsin defense is playing phenomenally, but this Wisconsin offense is definitely struggling. There's no question, Ryan.
Yeah, Graham Mertz has not been good. I'd argue like four of the last five games, but let's just look at the last three games specifically. He's completing 40% of his passes, but it hasn't mattered because Wisconsin's defense in the three games since their bye has been Wisconsin-esque of old. Now, that obviously doesn't bode well for Minnesota's offense. I don't know exactly why that is yet. I'm going to have to dig into the tape, talk to our Wisconsin 24/7 people, see what's changed. But it's the defense that's been leading them because Braylon Allen got nicked up in this game. Looks like Ches Malusi came back, their running back. But if Graham Mertz is going to be this version, I know that the line for this game right now is Wisconsin -3 against the Gophers. I would argue Minnesota matches up better against Wisconsin than they did against Iowa, but I'll see what I think in 72 hours after I've had more time to kind of get into what Wisconsin looks like here in the last month. But it's just Nebraska's going to Nebraska themselves, whether it's Scott Frost, whether it's Mickey Joseph. It's just it's truly remarkable, fellas.
All right, and probably the most or the tightest contest of all of Saturday, Indiana gets their second Big Ten win on the season. They win 39-31 in, I believe, double overtime. Just a phenomenal ending. You know, great for those guys. A tough one for Michigan State, Derek. Man, they've had an up and down season to say the least.
Well, this one. Indiana was counted for dead. I mean, Michigan State got off to a huge lead. I think it was a 3-score lead in the first half. Indiana comes roaring back, sends it into overtime, and, you know, one of those things you do not see in an entire season of college football. In overtime, I believe Michigan State gets stopped in overtime and has to kick a field goal. Indiana blocks the field goal. So now Indiana has the next possession. All they have to do is sit on the ball three times and kick a field goal to win it. Effectively, that's what they do. Indiana's field goal gets blocked on the opposite possession in overtime. So sends it into a second overtime. Indiana ends up winning it. But just one of those early games that just added to the wild nature. And Indiana finally comes out with a win, and Michigan State, I'll just continue to say, maybe the most bipolar team in the Big Ten this year.
Well, the only thing I would note here is you look at the stats, and it doesn't make any sense on how Indiana scored 39 points and had 11 first downs. Michigan State had 29 first downs to 11 for Indiana. They almost had 250 more total yards than the Hoosiers. So how in the world is Indiana even remotely in this game? Special teams. You guys already alluded to it, but they just played such a huge part in giving them any life. I mean, there was, a kickoff return for a touchdown. You mentioned the block field goals. Like, that's how Indiana's in this game, and that's how Michigan State is now fighting for their lives in terms of bowl eligibility. They needed that win to get it because I'm guessing they ain't going to get it in Happy Valley next weekend.
All right, so let's talk maybe a tiny bit about this Wisconsin game coming up to cap off the regular season. Minnesota needs to win this game to stay above 500 in the Big Ten. This would move PJ Fleck to 500 in his career in Big Ten games, which is no small feat given where he started. And he deserves credit for that. But you know, this is a Wisconsin team that has fired their coach. They are going to hire Leonard. I don't think there's any question about that. I know they've posted the job now, but everyone says that it's Leonard's job. So it'll be interesting. Ryan, I'll let you start, you know, and just give some early thoughts.
My first early thought is a shameless plug, because this week is also Thanksgiving, which means Black Friday. And if you enjoy, or you have enjoyed listening to me on this podcast, KFAN, Pair and a Spare, reading me on Twitter, and you've never actually taken the plunge and gotten behind the paywall at GI, I'll tell you right now, I don't think I'm supposed to be telling people this, but if you want to become a new member, it's going to be 75% off for Black Friday, which is going to start Wednesday for us, run through Monday. 75% off. That is a savings of like $90 for an entire GI membership. It's like $2 a month for the entire year. So if you enjoy listening or reading or interacting with me, wherever it may be, we're a month from signing day. We're 2 weeks from the portal opening. I have more gray hairs in my head in the next 30 days than I will get in the 10 days that precede that of my wedding. So if you have ever thought, or you've talked to somebody who wanted to become a GI member, but for whatever reasons, financially, it didn't make sense, I'm telling you right now, here's your warning. On Wednesday, it's going to be 75% off for new members for an annual subscription. Take the plunge. Come interact with me, because as much context as I give on this podcast, everybody behind the paywall on the GI message board gets it first. There is literally a thread called the Ask Ryan Burns thread. Luke, can you guess how many posts and how many eyeballs have been on
it? It's like a million. It's ridiculous.
There are 17,500 posts on there, and the page views on that thread, 2.48 million. Like, I am on the GI message board. If my eyes are open, I'm on GI. If you have a question, I'm answering it. So this is me saying, if you want a deal, you've been waiting, it's the holidays, you know somebody, I'd love for you to become a member. But with the Wisconsin team, it comes down to this. You got to go to Camp Randall. You've played well there, I would argue, the last two times. That would be 2018, where you got the axe, 2020, where you weren't able to close it. And now you get this Wisconsin version that is interesting offensively, but I don't know what they're going to look like without Braylon Allen. If he plays, if he doesn't, I mean, we saw how ineffective he was last year. If there's one thing I would say, Derek, Joe Rossi has figured out the Wisconsin offense the last 3 years.
Yeah, that's been they've looked incredibly good against that Wisconsin offense. And the other side of the coin is, whether it's Minnesota or any other team, if Wisconsin isn't able to control the game on offense by running the ball, they have really struggled. So it's going to be, I think Braylon Allen's going to be a key to this. If he's not playing, that's a difference. The other side of it, though, is, I mean, if we were talking about this game 4 or 5 weeks ago, I would have felt a lot better, and because Wisconsin just, you know, things were very off. But as you touched on, their defense has really rounded into form, and they've looked exceptionally good at home in the last few weeks. Sure. Last couple games they played at home. So those two things give me pause. But yes, offensively, I think Joe Rossi has done well. Wisconsin has not done well in every game being able to control it. So I think if you add those things up, Minnesota is able to keep them off schedule. Things look pretty good.
It should be a great game. I mean, it should be. Again, this is where you want to end it, is for the Axe. You're 2-2 in your last four. And in Vegas essentially says this game's a pickup. So it's going to be a lot of fun to get into a little bit later this week, Luke.
Yeah, so we want to thank everyone for listening. We appreciate all the support we've gotten this year. Do support Ryan and his work. Do support Derek and the work at Dinkytown Athletes. We appreciate all of our sponsors. Do please support them. They make this possible. Again, thank you for listening, and go Gophers.